I found that this war has the classic trademarks of the wars we see today. It's got a big false flag sinking out the main. It's got bankers in control of the White House from behind the scenes. It's got bankers who are pushing for the war. And it's got Americans being propelled to war by fake atrocity stories and then going overseas to fight for freedom and democracy.
You're listening to The Corbett Report.
Welcome, friends. James Corbett here, CorbettReport.com, in a conversation that's being recorded on the 10th of February, 2016. And I know all of my listeners at home are thinking to themselves, 10th of February, 2016? That can only mean one thing. It's 5 days until the 118th anniversary of the sinking of the USS Maine in Havana Harbor. Or maybe you weren't thinking about that, but at any rate, we're going to use that somewhat flimsy pretense for an important conversation, which is to talk about something that I think is neglected all too much in both the historical mainstream textbooks and the alternative media, and that's the Spanish-American War. I'm sure that you'll all at least be familiar with the sinking of the Maine and to hell with Spain and something about William Randolph Hearst and you provide the pictures and I'll provide the war, something along those lines, but what was the Spanish-American War really about? What was it supposed to be about? And what was it really about? And who were the belligerents? And who was really pulling the strings behind the scenes? These are some important issues that aren't explored nearly often enough, but they have been explored by our guest today, James Perloff, who you will remember, of course, from jamesperloff.com and the author of such books as Truth is a Lonely Warrior, which we have discussed on this program in the past. So I'll put a link to that conversation in the show notes for this episode, as well as to James Perloff's website, and to a 2012 New American Magazine article called Trial Run for Interventionism, about this topic of the Spanish-American War. Lots of good information in there, so I hope you will go and read that article. But let's bring him on the program. James Perloff, thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you, James, for having me on what may be the number one truther program on the internet.
Wow, my ears are burning. Well, thank you very much for that. Well, let's get straight into the meat and potatoes of this. As I say, the Spanish-American War is not something that gets a lot of attention, even in the alternative media, although maybe it should. There's a lot of interesting nuggets in here that you've drawn out in your article. But let's start with the mainstream history of what we're expected to believe about the Spanish-American War. What was this all about?
Well, of course, it was a war between Spain and America in 1898. It was principally fought over Cuba, which had been a Spanish colony until then. And what most people remember about it from their mainstream textbook is that the Maine blew up that led to our involvement. It was sort of the immediate trigger point. We had one-sided naval victories in Manila, the Philippines, which the Spain then controlled. The Spanish then controlled, and in Santiago Harbor, and of course the famous charge up San Juan Hill, and it was called a splendid little war by the American Secretary of State John Hay, and that's kind of how it got characterized, a splendid little war for America. But in reviewing it, and I found that nobody had actually analyzed this war. We looked at other things like World War One and the Lusitania, but nobody really looked that much at the Maine and the Spanish-American War. And I just want to, before we get into the real motives for this war, I just want to mention why this is a relevant conversation. I found that this war has the classic trademarks of the wars we see today. It's got a big false flag sinking out the main. It's got bankers in control of the White House from behind the scenes. It's got bankers who are pushing for the war. And it's got Americans being propelled to war by fake atrocity stories and then going overseas to fight for freedom and democracy. Does that sound familiar in our Middle East wars? So things haven't changed that much. It always helps to understand the present when we understand the past. So that's the significance, I think, of the war. But that will all come out in the details in this conversation.
Let's start, as you do in your article, by talking about the build-up to the war, because as you note, I think throughout the 19th century, there was a drastic change that happened from the beginning of the 19th century to the end of the 19th century to make the American public interested in this idea of interventionism and going abroad to protect America's interests at home, something that I think is not natural to the spirit that the country was founded on, or however you want to put it. And I think the Spanish-American War is the beginning of this 21st century American empire, as we now know it. So let's talk about how the American public was motivated to go to war with Spain.
Okay, you're right. This is the very first war for another country. And that's why I call this trial run for interventionism. In America, we had traditionally regarded our military's purpose as being self-defense. And this was the first war that we went overseas on to fight for somebody else. And so in the public mind, we were fighting for Cuba's independence. I should mention there were a few ironies to this because, you know, one of the outcomes of the war was that we took over all of Spain's colonies. We took over Puerto Rico. We took over the Philippines. We took over Guam. And while we're doing that, we also managed to annex Hawaii, even though it didn't belong to Spain. But these were the rest of these countries were all colonies of Spain. And one of the ironies of this was that when soldiers went down to Cuba, they were told they were going to free the Cubans from colonial rule and we're fighting colonialism. And yet we ourselves absorbed Spain's colonies. So this required a little bit of Orwellian newspeak. We said that the Philippines and Puerto Rico, they're not colonies, they're just possessions. Another irony was that we were told we were fighting for the self-determination of other people, fighting for the self-determination of the Cuban people. Yet when we took over the Philippines, you know, they had a national independence movement under a guy named Aguinaldo. And they actually helped us fight the Spanish in the Philippines, thinking that we were going to liberate them when it was all over. We suppressed the Filipino independence movement, killing 20,000 Filipinos in combat and about 200,000 more as civilians as a side effect of the war. So there was quite a bit of irony in this war. One other thing I should mention about it is in terms of buildup, the Monroe Doctrine was invoked here as justification for the war. You know, the Monroe Doctrine enunciated by President Monroe in 1823 said that we would not allow the Europeans to interfere in our hemisphere. But Monroe did not apply that to existing colonies like Cuba. If he had, then we would have gone to war with over Cuba with Spain right away. The irony in this one, James, is that the basic precept of the Monroe Doctrine is that people should stay in their own hemisphere and mind their own business. So what are we doing taking over the Philippines? So there's a lot of explaining to do, but when you control the media and you control the politicians, that's not too hard to convince people of.
Well, then let's start right there with the media, which obviously played a large role in every war, but certainly in this war. Let's talk about Hearst, Yellow Publishing, and the journal.
Well, to get people to want to fight the Spanish, they had to make people think that there was a lot of suffering that was the fault of the Spanish in Cuba. And so Hearst invented a lot of stories about what the Spaniards were doing. And I should mention, of course, back in those days, newspapers were mass media. There was no radio or television or internet yet, of course. And so he dreamed up things like this: the Spanish were roasting Cuban priests. I'm going to read a headline to you. This is from his New York Journal, 1896. Quote, "Cubans fed to sharks, cries heard at night. They're taken outside the harbor, and the silent ferryman comes back alone." And here's one from his rival newspaper. This was Joseph Pulitzer's New York World. Quote, "Raided a hospital, more than 40 sick and wounded Cubans butchered." But the truth is that there was no hospital in that area at all. This is a made-up story. Another one from Hearst. "Butchered 300 Cuban women, defenseless prisoners shot down by Spanish soldiers." He found that, you know, James, traditionally it's stories about women, babies, and children will pull at the heartstrings of readers. And this has been a proven success story. Used to get a bit, think of the incubator babies and the Gulf War of 91. In terms of women, let me just show you a picture from Hearst newspaper. This was under the headline, refined young women stripped and searched by brutal Spaniards while under our flag. And this is pretty racy for 1890 culture, but this picture, which was created by Frederick Remington, the famous artist who was hired by Hearst, when you got money, you can hire the best. The truth is that a young woman had been searched on an American steamer, but not by young Spanish ruffians. She was searched in private by a Spanish woman. She was a suspected revolutionary, and the Spanish thought she might have some relevant documents. And Remington, who drew that picture, had never even seen the incident. So it was taking a tiny grain of truth and transforming it into an atrocity story that would make people want to go to war. And by the way, the woman was dark-skinned, not light, but they had to make her light-skinned to appeal to the chivalrous instincts of white Americans. So there's a lot of this going on. Let me show you one more picture, and I sent you this, and you may, if you put graphics into our show, I already include this, but here's an image. The Spanish brute, it shows a Spaniard who's half-human and half ape, because it's much easier to kill the enemy when he's not fully human. And he's got his bloody dagger in his hand on the grave of the Maine, the sailors who died on the Maine, even though there was no evidence that Spain had anything to do with that. And he's trampling the American flag underfoot as if to say, come on down here, you Americans, I dare you. I dare you to fight me here in Cuba. And point of fact, the last thing Spain wanted was a war with America.
Yes, and I mean, it's just so ridiculous that we would tend to scoff at it. But as you point out, it was just a few decades ago with the incubator babies in Iraq. It was just a few years ago with Viagra being fed to troops by Gaddafi. And it was just a year or two ago with Assad chemical weaponing his own people, right?
Sarin gas.
Yes, yeah. Again.
Same old tricks,
and people continue to buy it. So we shouldn't get up on too much of a high horse deriding the intelligence of people back in that time. Well, absolutely. The media is exceptionally important in stirring up that American passion for going to war with the Spaniards, who they had no particular qualm with until that point. But the other side of this, as you mentioned before, is not just control of the press, but control of the politicians who make the decisions about where and how to commit troops and all of that. So let's talk about the political puppets that were being pulled in order to set up the pieces on this chessboard.
Here's where it gets important to talk about National City Bank. National City Bank was controlled by the Rockefellers. John D.'s kid brother, William Rockefeller, was sitting on the board. And they were the most powerful bank in America. In fact, let me give you a quote from the historian Ferdinand Lundberg in his great book, America's 60 Families. He said, quote, National City Bank during McKinley's incumbency was significantly more closely involved in administration affairs than any other bank, unquote. Of course, our president then was William McKinley. And let me talk a little about why National City Bank wanted this war, and then let me talk about how they controlled the White House. Cuba, by the 19th century, had become the world's wealthiest colony, and it was the world's biggest sugar producer. And in those days, sugar was called white gold, just as the Rockefellers' oil was called black gold. And as the wealthiest colony in the world, Cuba was a prize target, and the Rockefellers wanted to get control of it. And that was a prime motive for them wanting to get in there. And just to back this up, that sugar was really a top motive here, let me quote Mark Twain. He said of the Spanish-American War, quote, how our hearts burned with indignation over the atrocious Spaniards. But when the smoke was over, the dead buried, and the cost of war came back to the people in price increases, that is, when we sobered up from our patriotic spree, it suddenly dawned on us that the cause of the Spanish-American War was the price of sugar. But I want to back this up a little bit more. Lundberg wrote, quote, of the Spanish-American War, the quote, the Rockefeller-Stillman National City Bank benefited most directly from it. For Cuba, the Philippines, and indeed all of Latin America soon afterward became dotted with National City Bank branches, unquote. William Guy Carr, in his great book, Pawns in the Game, quote, National City Bank owned and controlled Cuba's sugar industry when the war ended. I might add in Major General Smedley Butler, who I know many of your listeners know was the most decorated Marine in history. When he died in 1940, he wrote War is a Racket, And he said, quote, I've spent 34 years in active service as a member of the Marines. And during that time, I spent most of it being a high-class muscle man for big business. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for National Citibank to collect revenues, unquote. And, of course, that was his first action, was in the Spanish-American War. And just to back this up a little further, this is probably hard for people to see, but I found this on eBay. It's an old National Citibank ad for Cuban sugar. You see the guy there with the sugar cane, and it's got the National Citibank logo. They're glorifying the benefits of National Citibank's sugar. And just as a little more backup, here are some of the sugar companies that National Citibank controlled. The General Sugar Company, which was all over Cuba, the Cuban American Sugar Corporation, the Guantanamo Sugar Company, the Cuban Dominican Sugar and West Indies Corporation, the Atlantic Fruit and Sugar Company, the Warner Sugar Company, the West Indies Sugar Company, the Cuba Company, and on the list goes. And I might also mention that James Post, who was on the National Citibank board, was also the president of the National Sugar Refining Company. And finally, I should mention that Frank Vanderlip, the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, who oversaw a $200 million bond issue that financed the fighting of the war. That's where they got most of the income to finance the war. After the war, he was made vice president and then president of Citibank. And again, as many of your informed listeners and viewers may know, Frank Vanderlip went on to attend the famous Jekyll Island meeting where the Federal Reserve was formed.
And I believe he was the one who spilled the beans in the Saturday Evening Post in 1935 about that secret meeting, confessing to the crime, but being quite proud about it. Well, then let's talk about another person who had, an important effect on this war, Teddy Roosevelt. What was he up to in 1898?
Well, Teddy was the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury. He was very, very bellicose about
Assistant Secretary of the...
I'm sorry, I've already covered one assistant secretary. That was Frank Vanderlip. We're talking about he's assistant secretary of the Navy. And as you know, James, quite often it's the assistant secretaries or the deputy secretaries that have the real power, just like many people consider, of course, Dick Cheney the real power behind George Bush. And when Paul Warburg ran the Federal Reserve, he was the vice chairman, but everybody knows he was the chairman de facto of the Federal Reserve. Well, Teddy Roosevelt was the de facto Secretary of the Navy, and while the real secretary was gone for the day, he ordered Admiral Dewey to, before the war even began, to go to the Philippines and to prepare to attack the Spanish Navy there. And of course, he later formed the Rough Riders and was famed for his exploits there, but he certainly turned that to advantage because while the war, which only lasted 4 months, took place during the summer of 1898, by November of 1898, Teddy had become governor of New York, and by 1901 was president of the United States. And just to draw a little continuity, when the Lusitania went down, it was his cousin Franklin D. Roosevelt, who was assistant secretary of the Navy, who then went on to become governor of New York and then president of the United States. So, you know, they keep it in the family, like with Clinton and Bush. You see a lot of these factors, just a lot of common threads running through these events.
Unfortunately so. Well, I guess if a criminal finds a game plan that works, they stick to it. And criminal families stick together as well. All right, so we have all of these pieces on the table, but the real catalyzing event, the Pearl Harbor, if you will, of this particular war, was the sinking of the Maine. What happened on February 15th, 1898?
James, this was a huge disaster. The Maine exploded. 9:40 p.m. It was in Havana Harbor at the time, and 266 sailors lost their lives. And if you've seen the wreckage of the Maine, this is a steel battleship. It was turned into a twisted hulk. Only 16 men went uninjured of the 355 crew. Horrible disaster. It's the 9/11 of the Spanish-American War. But we should start to ask some questions. Now, we went to war with a battle cry, Remember the Maine, and to hell with Spain. First question to ask is, what's the Maine doing there in the first place? Why did we send a battleship down to this country? Well, the decision to send the Maine down there was made at a White House meeting. And if we have a chance, I want to talk a little about McKinley's connection to National Citibank. But this decision was made on January the 24th to send the Maine to Havana And the Spaniards, we let them know a battleship would be coming, but we didn't tell them it would be the very next day. And James, I have to think that just to set the context a little bit, there had been an incident that had occurred before where the Spanish fired on an American ship, a merchant ship that they thought was running guns. And I have to think that somebody hoped that when the Maine sailed in unexpectedly, because not even the American consulate had been informed of its arrival, nobody in Havana knew the ship was coming in, somebody hoped that the firing would take place because relations were very tense with Spain at this moment, but it didn't. So the Maine just stayed in Havana Harbor for 3 weeks, doing nothing, accomplishing no purpose. The official explanation was it was a courtesy call, but how courteous is a battleship? The other explanation was it was protecting American interests, but what interests? I mean, there were Americans down in Cuba, but the Spaniards were not in any way molesting them. And if there were Americans being molested, how would a battleship helping Americans who were inland? So no reason to be there. The Spanish were quite courteous. They took the crew to the officers to a bullfight, but the Spaniards didn't know why it was there. But then the Maine blew up, and they got the blame. Let's talk a little bit about why Spain would not have been the ones to blow up the Maine. Spain was bending over backwards to avoid this war. They had caved into every demand we made. We didn't like their governor, Valeriano Weyler, so they recalled Weyler. They said, we want freedom for the Cuban people. So they said, okay, we'll give them a legislature. We'll give them semi-autonomy like Canada has with Britain. We said we don't like various policies, which I won't go into here, but they caved in on every demand because they knew that we had a steel navy and they had a essentially wooden navy. They had no chance to win what would be essentially a naval war against America. And that was borne out by these military encounters, the Battle of Manila and the Battle of Santiago in Cuba. We wiped out their Pacific squadron and their Caribbean squadron entirely. Every ship was destroyed. We didn't lose one ship. And, James, we only had one casualty in each battle, and one of those was from a heart attack because we had greater firepower, greater firing range, and, again, a steel navy against a wood navy. No chance. In fact, I'll quote their Admiral Cervera. He said to his own government, "We lack everything that is necessary for a naval war, such as supplies, ammunition, coal, provisions. We have nothing at all," unquote. And also to fight this war in Cuba, they had to travel 4,000 miles. We had to travel 100 miles. They don't want to fight the mighty United States of America. So they're not going to do something like blowing up the Maine to provoke us. So when you see an event like the Maine, you have to ask what benefited, who benefited.
Yes, and I think the obvious modern parallel to that would be something like with Assad in Syria, where Obama supposedly drew the red line of chemical weapons. Mm-hmm. And so what possible reason would Assad have for using chemical weapons on his own people? It's just a ridiculous story that makes no sense. Who benefits from it? Well, clearly the rebels who are trying to overthrow Assad. So I think there's some pretty obvious parallels going on there. But let's talk about the actual explosion itself. What do we know about what actually went down?
James, I wish I could tell people that we know for sure how the Maine sank. It's a little bit like 9/11, where there's arguments about how the buildings collapsed. Was it nukes? Was it thermite? Was it directed energy? There have been six total investigations into the sinking of the Maine that were formal or official in nature. There was the original American Naval Court of Inquiry. The Spanish held their own court of inquiry. They wanted to do it jointly with us, but we refused. When the Maine was eventually raised in 1911, we did another Naval Court of Inquiry. There was a fourth inquiry by Hyman Rickover, the admiral, in 1974, and also National Geographic. And the Discovery Channel did their own inquiries in recent years using modern computers and simulations to try to determine what happened. The bad news is that three of those investigations decided that the Maine sank from an internal cause, such as a coal bunker fire, and three said it was from an external source, such as a mine or torpedo. So they don't leave us a lot to go on. My own suspicion is that it might have been something external because of the timing. 9:40 at night, it kind of sounds like someone was waiting for nightfall so they could approach the main. And I kind of doubt that it would have been easy to plant a device on a warship with 355 pretty alert sailors on board and expect that that would go off by itself. So we don't know for sure what took down the main, but we can be pretty positive that it was not the Spaniards who planned this event.
All right. So once again, the actual fight took 4 months. The actual war took 4 months to wrap up. What is left at the end, and how did National City Bank and the others, what did they directly gain from this?
Well, as we went over, they directly gained control of the Cuban sugar industry. I should just mention, just to connect dots a little bit more, if you don't mind, James, I just want to mention their connection to President McKinley. President McKinley was from Ohio, former governor of Ohio. And in fact, we've had 8 presidents come from Ohio, which is the home of Standard Oil, and I don't think that's a coincidence. When McKinley was governor of Ohio, he went bankrupt, and he had to be bailed out by a group of bankers led by Mark Hanna, who was a front man for John D. Rockefeller. When the state of Ohio was going to press a antitrust suit against Standard Oil, it was Mark Hanna who threatened their attorney general with a bribe or oblivion. He chose oblivion. But Mark Hanna led the bailout of Governor William McKinley. He bailed him out of $100,000 debt, which was the equivalent of close to $3 million in today's dollars. He then became McKinley's political manager, his campaign manager. And when McKinley went to the White House, he arranged to have a current Ohio senator become Secretary of State as a reward for his services to Standard Oil, named John Long. And then he had the governor of Ohio appoint Mark Hanna to be the new senator in Long's place from Ohio, and invited Mark Hanna to live right in the White House, believe it or not. His relationship was very similar to the relationship that Edward Mandel House had with Wilson. Here's a contemporary drawing of the day. It shows Hanna and McKinley in the White House carving up the presidential turkey on a plate called Sound Money, which represents the money interests of the day. So he was he had IOUs. He was beholden to the bankers. And again, I quoted earlier Ferdinand Lundberg on the fact that National City Bank was more involved with White House affairs than any other bank. But to get to the results of this, James, I wanted to mention that, like a lot of wars, this was a multidimensional war. It was not just about sugar. One of the things was to change America's perception about the purpose of our military, that we're now a police force. And James, I know, 100% familiar with the concept of boil the frog. I recently did an article on gun control called It's Only 1%. You know, Obama saying, all I want is 1% of your guns, the ones that belong to people on watch lists and people who are mentally impaired. And I'm drawing that from the 1% income tax. Income tax started as 1%, and people were promised it'll never be above 1%, but they boiled the frog. And I may be wrong about this, but I think that the Spanish-American War was a little like that. It was a quick, easy victory. And I think they wanted to give Americans the impression that, look at these, we almost had no casualties in these naval engagements. I think they wanted people to get the idea that going abroad to fight wars was going to be a piece of cake. If you look at it, our next war is World War I. That's our next foreign invention. That lasts for about a year, 1917 to 1918. World War II, we bring it up to 3 years. Now we're fighting endless wars against an endless enemy called ISIS. So I think they kind of built up the gradient that one. I should mention that part of this was to unify the North and South into this fighting force. And in order to accomplish that objective, McKinley appointed old Confederate generals to fight alongside old Union generals in commanding the Spanish-American War operation. They wanted to get rid of that longstanding belligerence that Southerners felt towards the North, They wanted them to get to a point where they would fight alongside the Yankees in this long-term plan for a national police force in the form of the United States military. And I'm just going to mention something, James, that may sound a little off topic, but there are two movies that have come out historically that were very pro-Southern. One you may have heard of, you may have seen it. It was called Birth of a Nation. It even glorified the Ku Klux Klan and had Southerners cheering all over. The other, of course, was Gone with the Wind. And that premiered in Atlanta, and the Southerners cheering again. I may be wrong, but my feeling is that with Birth of a Nation coming out in 1913, that's 1 year before World War I began. Gone with the Wind's 1939, the year that World War II began. I believe that they were trying to get Southerners to get rid of those old grudges against the North, stemming going back to the war and the Reconstruction period, to say, "Yeah, we're welcome in America again. We feel part of America again, and we'll fight alongside those Yankees when they go to fight in the trenches of Europe." I should mention some other aspects of this war, some other motives that went along with it. Besides acquiring those colonies, I should mention, by the way, James, that Puerto Rico, Hawaii, and the Philippines all had big sugar industries as well. So this is another plum for the National City Bank, who put branches into those arenas as well. But there's another factor in this too, if I may. It was the destruction of the Populist Party. This is another parallel to today. Believe it or not, people were wising up in the 1890s to the fact that there's no real difference between the Republican Party and the Democrats. And so they formed what was called the People's Party, the Populist Party. It was anti-Wall Street. So what do they do today when you complain about we're losing our civil liberties and our economy is about to bust and the dollar's about to go down? They say, look, it's ISIS. And so this is very similar. They said, oh, you're worried about John D. Rockefeller and J.P. Morgan forming this monopoly? Look, it's Spain. It's a Spanish brute. We have to do something about Spain. We've got to do something about their threatening our liberties. They're infringing on our hemisphere. And so the war, people got caught up in it. When they heard about Commodore Dewey's victories, there were fireworks. It was like, we just won the Super Bowl, you know. And they forgot about the real enemy was right here at home in Wall Street, as the real threat to our liberties today is not the Arabs over in the Middle East. It's from coming from our own government. So this was another parallel. And I have to say that after 1896, the Populist Party lost its force. It lost its vigor. And real quick parallel, in World War I, a very similar thing was going on. They decided to reform the parties from within. Robert La Follette, Charles Lindbergh, trying to reform the Republican Party. That all got lost. And the enemies of World War I, the Germans. And I showed you the Spanish brute. Now it's the German brute, the ape dressed in the Kaiser's helmet. So once again, the attempt to reform American politics was pushed aside. And there's one other aspect to this war I think I should mention that might be lost to people. You're familiar with the Anglo-American establishment that Carol Quigley wrote a book about by that name. It got its start in the Spanish-American War. You know, up until that time, America still had this lingering resentment towards England. They were our old enemy, the ones that once ruled us as a colony. And, you know, they said that the reason that Americans drink coffee is still an inheritance from the Boston Tea Party. We resented the British. We even changed the spelling of our words. So when we spelled the word color, we wouldn't use the letter U in it, you know. So they had to get rid of that to form this fighting force, this Anglo-American fighting force. So I found out that England was the only country that supported us during the Spanish-American War. When Spain tried to form a European coalition against us during the war, the British leaked that plan to us. And when, before we attacked Puerto Rico, a British ship docked there, and an American officer got out, his name was Harry Whitney, and he spied out the land in a British officer's uniform. And when we bombarded the Spanish fleet in Manila, the British fleet protectively stood between us and the German fleet. Now, some people say they just wanted a better view of the battle, but I think that they were definitely there as a game saver for us. And this is pretty interesting. In 1898, while the war was going on, the Anglo-American League was formed with branches in America and Britain. And this became, evolved, it was known as the Pilgrim Society. And let me mention who some of the original members of the Pilgrim Society were that came out of this American Anglo-American League. John D. Rockefeller Jr., Andrew Carnegie, Paul Warburg, founder of the Fed, Jacob Schiff, head of Kuhn Loeb, the Rothschild representative, Nelson Aldrich, who introduced the original Federal Reserve legislation, our old friend Frank Vanderlip, and the original vice president of Pilgrim Society in America was J.P. Morgan himself. And on the other side of the Atlantic, you've got Nathan Rothschild as a member, Montagu Norman, head of the Bank of England, and Winston Churchill. So it's a mini Bilderberger group, and its motto was Hic et Ubique, which is a Latin for here and everywhere. Aren't these America and England here and everywhere? Tony Blair and George Bush carrying on this tradition to this very day. And Ubique is also on the motto of the Council on Foreign Relations, and surprise, many of these people later became either members of the Council on Foreign Relations or the Royal Institute of International Affairs, which are respectively the two groups that control foreign policy in both countries. So you've got a lot of things coming out of this war.
Indeed. Well, lots of juicy nuggets in this article, so I will once again direct people's attention to it. We'll link it up in the show notes for this interview, Trial Run for Interventionism, and a lot of the different things that you're talking about here are in that article. But I guess, there are no footnotes in the article itself, so let's talk a little bit about sources. Where should people be going if they want more of the details of what you're talking about here?
James, when I told the New American I'd like to write an article on this war, I ran into a brick wall when I went to mainstream media books in the library, and all they were telling me were the things I already knew about Teddy Roosevelt and his Rough Riders. And I wanted to get to the meat of the matter, and I found only by really deep digging could I find out the facts that we've reviewed today. One of the best books I found was this one. It's Fakes and Facts About Cuba by George Bronson Ray. Now, this is a reprint, but it was published in 1897. Ray was a former captain in the American Army, but he lived in Cuba for many years working as an engineer on a sugar plantation. And unlike William Randolph Hearst reporters who just stayed in the bars of Havana and never went out into the field, he actually rode with the rebels for 9 months. And he also rode with the Spanish, and so he knew firsthand. And in his book, he takes those specific stories coming from William Randolph Hearst, and he proves, hey, there's no this victory that Hearst is claiming for the rebels. They weren't even within 50 miles of that town, in this town where they say they murdered all the hospital patients. There wasn't even a hospital there. So he was a great resource, very hands-on, very honest. He was a truther in his day. And another great book was, you can't see the cover on this, but it's a book I mentioned before. It's America's 60 Families. You have to get it in old library copies today. They don't reprint it, but it was the best book I found on the McKinley administration and the Wall Street connections that were running it. And another great book, which is relatively recent, was The Politics of War by Walter Karp. He spoke in depth about the political motivations for the war, and he's the one I learned about the Populist Party and how they were trying to destroy that with this war, this multidimensional war. And I found one mainstream book that was pretty good was A Spanish War by G.J.A. O'Toole, and he was the one who talked about the Anglo-American League, and that was another piece of news to me. So if people were to go to just those four books, they would get almost all the information you see in that article that I penned for the New American in 2012.
Excellent stuff. Well, an important piece of history, as you say, touches on many of the facts of what we're living through even today. And I guess if you take nothing else out of today's conversation, it could be the idea that when you see a Hollywood movie trying to make Southerners feel good about their place in the Union again, brace yourself for World War III. All right. James Perloff, always a wealth of information. Let's direct people again to jamesperloff.com and to your book, Truth is a Lonely Warrior, and your other books available there at the website. I hope people will check it out. Thank you again for your time today.
Thank you so much, James, for having me on. Great host and great information. Great work you're doing on behalf of Truth.
Thank you.